So what I want to talk about briefly this morning, or this afternoon, is filters in 2D, because there's a lot of interesting things you can do with filters in two dimensions. Particularly, these are used often for image manipulation, image processing. What's image processing? Well, it's a whole grab bag of things that we do to images to make them look different, or to pull out particular features in those images, or whatever. So I have an image here. An image is just a two-dimensional signal. It's sampled at points, which we call pixels, and you can see there's 250 of them in each direction in this particular image. What I have along this color bar here is an indication of the values, so that these colors are associated with some scale. You can see the dark blue values correspond to 0, the red values correspond to 1. So this picture is just a circle of value 1 in a blank background. A very standard, sort of simple little test picture for us. We can calculate the power spectrum of it. We already know how to do two-dimensional Fourier transforms. Not surprisingly, the power spectrum looks approximately radially symmetric, because this is approximately radially symmetric. If I took a cross-section through this power spectrum, though, it would be like taking a cross-section through here. If you take a cross-section through here, you get a rectangular pulse. If I take the Fourier transform of a rectangular pulse, what do I get? A sinc. So if I take a cross-section through here, I'll see something that looks like a sinc squared function, because I'm looking at the power. Again, the scale here gives you an idea of the values. You can see these red values are large, blue means small values. The scale here is in dB, so it's a log scale. So what sort of filters can we use? Well, this is a simple one. This is just going to be the equivalent of our rectangular window moving average. So it's, instead of being a rectangle in one direction, like a, you know, just a vector of ones, we have a square array of ones, and I've divided by 49 just because this is a 7x7 array, there's 49 terms there. If I didn't do that, then I would have a gain of 49 when I did my filter. So it's a simple filter, simple like a rectangular moving average in the time domain. When we're dealing with images, we don't typically worry about causal filters too much, because for an image, there's no time, there's no notion of what happened first, what happened afterwards. You better fill one of these out too.
Okay.
So there's no problem in having a symmetric moving average. So what I've done here is I've just taken my filter and I've padded it with zeros. All of these guys are zeros, and this is the 7x7 array in the middle. It's a little bit hard to see, but if you look carefully, you see there's a little red blob, little red square in the middle, 7x7 of those coefficients. What happens when I pad a pad in the time domain? Well, I get a kind of interpolated version of my Fourier transform. Same thing here. I get this nice, smoother looking Fourier transform. If I just did it for a 7x7 block, I'd only get a 7x7 Fourier transform here. It'd be kind of hard to see what's going on. So by padding, I give myself a nicer picture here. The other thing to think about is when I do the convolution between my filter and the image, there are a couple of ways of dealing with the edges, remember. One way would be to do a circular convolution, but we don't typically do circular convolutions for images. Typically with images, we truncate in some way. And the way I'm going to do it here is I'm going to assume that everything beyond the edge of my filter, beyond the edge of these guys, is zero. So equally, I could write my filter like this with a whole lot of zeros everywhere else, and then do my convolution. The zeros don't contribute to the convolution. So there's no problem with them in adding them into the filter. When I do it, it just makes my Fourier transform a little bit more obvious what's going on. And what is going on? Well, again, if I look across this guy, just look at a cross-section through here, I'll see a rectangular pulse. When I take the Fourier transform of the rectangular pulse, I get a sinc function. So if I look across here and looked at the values, I'd see a sinc function. It looks a lot different from this one. Firstly, because it's not radially symmetric anymore. It's just got symmetries in the horizontal and vertical direction. But also, you notice that this guy is wider. The sinc function here is narrower. This is a standard property. This is a result of the scaling property of the Fourier transform. If I squeeze in the time domain, I stretch out in the Fourier domain. If I stretch out in the time domain, then I'm going to squeeze things together in the Fourier domain. This is a general thing. This is something we have to get used to dealing with. So when I look at my filter, it's much... this guy's not working properly. It's much narrower in the time domain, and so its Fourier spectrum is more spread out. You see the nulls in the spectrum are further apart. This is just the picture of that cross-section, just to show you that it does look like a sinc function, or in fact a sinc squared function in this case, because we're looking at power. So again, just to reinforce, this is just a cross-section of this guy through here. Okay, and this is the convolution of the two. So this is the convolution, this is the filtered signal. I take that image and I filter it with that convolution. What does it do? Well, you can see what it does is it blurs the edge. It's a smoother, it tends to smooth out that sharp edge. We had a sharp edge originally, now it's been blurred. You can see these intermediate values around the edge. In the frequency domain, you get an interesting picture. Let's just have a quick look at these other guys. It's this guy multiplied by this guy, and you can see that it's just the two kind of overlapping each other. Where the nulls were in either of the picture, we get nulls in this result. Where there are big values in both of them, we get big values in both of them. It's just the product of the two. So again, convolution in the time domain corresponds to a product in the frequency domain. We see the same thing again, even though we're doing things in two dimensions here. Here's another low-pass filter. This is an approximately Gaussian filter. We can't do an exact Gaussian with an image because the Gaussian distribution, remember, it supported infinite. It goes out to, it never goes to zero. So this is only ever going to be an approximation. Also, it's discrete samples of it, so it's only an approximation. What does that do? Well, this is its power spectrum. Again, same things we sort of talked about before. You notice the power spectrum is a lot smoother than the sinc function. That's because the Fourier transform of a Gaussian is a Gaussian. Fourier transform of a Gaussian is a Gaussian. So we expect to see something kind of smooth. It's a pretty small, tight, spiky Gaussian over here, though. So this one is pretty broad and spread out. If we made this one broader, it would make this one more spiky. So you know how to make your filter a better low-pass filter. You make a broader Gaussian over here, and it will filter only a smaller range of low frequencies over here. We have some idea of how to do that. Here's my signal. All I've done is put it through that filter. It doesn't look that different in the frequency domain. All that's really happened is these guys out here have been attenuated. So you can see there's some lower values out here. You notice again, same effect on the image. It tends to have smoothed out those edges. So this is what we call a blurring operation or a low pass. If you use Photoshop or one of those sort of programs, typically they have some operation which is called something like blur. That's what's happening. Another common operation we want to do on images is edge detection. I talked about this in the one-dimensional signal in the last lecture. Edge detection is just detecting a level shift, detecting a big change in contrast. How do we do that? Well, there's a bunch of different techniques, a bunch of different filters that are commonly used. The Sobel, the Pruitt, the Roberts filters are commonly used. There's a couple of others that I haven't seen used that often, but you can use things like Laplacians and Mars-Hildreth. I'll talk a little bit about these filters for us first, though. So these are the Sobel filters. There's two of them. Why are there two of them? Well, one of them looks for vertical edges and the other one looks for horizontal edges. And if we want to get all of the edges, hopefully in an image, we have to combine them. So what we do is we filter by this one, we filter by this one, we get two images, M vertical and M horizontal, and we take the square root of the sum of squares, and that will give us, hopefully, the edges in the image. And this function here should tell us the direction of the edges. It's like a phase. It tells us the angle that that edge is at. What do these functions look like? Well, let's ignore this part and this part for a second. Just look at the minus 2, 0, 2. That's a lot like a differencer. So this is a differencer going horizontally. If we look vertically, ignore those two columns, you've got 1, 2, 1. That's going to look a bit like a low pass filter, an averager. So what this is doing is smoothing in this direction and looking for edges in this direction, the horizontal direction. This one is going to be looking for edges vertically and smoothing things out a little bit horizontally. So this is a picture of the filters. Obviously you can't see very much here because it's only a 3x3 matrix. You notice zero is now green because we have minus and positive values in our filter. So you can hardly see it here, but the Fourier spectrum is very clear. Fourier spectrum, you can see there's this big null along here. This is going to be getting rid of these low frequencies in this direction. So actually it looks like a band pass filter. It's not really being a high pass filter here. It's tending to select these frequencies here when we look in this vertical direction. So these for the vertical components, it's filtering out the low pass, low frequencies in the vertical direction. In the horizontal direction, you can see it's a low pass filter. It's tending to get these low frequencies around this line and filter out the higher frequencies up here. So we sort of know what this filter is going to do. Here's my image, just the circle again. What did the filter do? Well, it picked out the horizontal edges here and here. Picked out the edges going across the image. That's edges when we look vertically. Think about a vertical pass through this thing. This is a sharp transition when we go vertically. So this is doing this high pass or band pass in this direction. It's smoothing things out a little bit in this direction. You notice that it doesn't just get the edge where you have this strictly horizontal part. It tends to get some of these sort of diagonal edges as well. And that's a good thing because we don't think that all of the edges in our images are always going to be exactly horizontal or vertical. There are going to be some that are at some angle. When we take this one and we combine it, this one, we're going to get a picture of all of the edges in this image. These are just cut through the frequency spectrum of that filter. So I take the two and I combine them together and I get a picture like this. You can see there are some different values in here. It's not perfectly homogeneous. So what we would typically do with an edge detected image like that is threshold it. So that's what I've done here. Anything above a threshold we set to 1, anything below the threshold we set to 0. And you can see that it's picked out the edge of that circle pretty nicely. There are other edge detecting filters. You could imagine making up a few of them yourself. The Pruitt one is a fairly commonly used filter. Again, these things are implemented in Photoshop and various things like that in GIMP. They're called edge detecting filters or things associated like that. The Roberts filter is interesting because it's a bit different. It's looking kind of for diagonal edges. Instead of looking for horizontal and vertical edges, it looks like a differencer in the diagonal direction. Same basic principle though. Here's our Laplacian filters. What they're trying to approximate is this Laplacian operator in continuous space. Again, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time, just point out that you can take that Fourier transform, and from this Fourier transform you can pretty much guess what that filter is actually going to do. You can see it looks pretty much like a low pass, except we're letting a little bit of high frequency stuff over here, and we can see what effect it has on this image. Okay, so image processing, there's a wealth of things out there that you can do. One of the nice little tricks that you can play with edge detected image is doing things like embossing an image. So what's happened here is I'm using grayscales instead of color, and all I've done is I've taken my horizontal sobel and my vertical sobel and multiplied them by a cosine and a sine with a particular angle theta. I think in this case it's pi on 6. So what's happened here? Well, let's take a line through this picture at an angle of about 30 degrees. The large values are bright, the small values are black. So what this has done is it's used the edge detector to pick out the edges and assign them values, and this side of the object, the circle, ends up with large values, this side of the circle ends up with low values, and it looks like shadows. So what you get is this effect as if this circle has been raised off of the page. This is a really common technique used in image processing. It's used in this sort of embossing operation, but it's also used in CGI. One of the problems with computer-generated imagery is the compute power needed to perform three-dimensional ray tracing. One of the cheats you can do is, instead of having an actual three-dimensional object, you just use an effect like this to make it visually appear three-dimensional. It's a pretty common little trick that people use all over the place. So here's a little picture of my son again, and I've just embossed the image by running an edge detector over that image and then creating this result. And you can see it kind of looks like parts of the image have been raised up. They've been embossed. Okay. So that's a little bit about two-dimensional filters. Nothing really new there, except to show you that all of the things we've been talking about for one-dimensional filters, they apply in two dimensions. They also apply in three dimensions or n dimensions. You can design filters for 12-dimensional space if you happen to have 12-dimensional data. So the next thing I want to talk about is linear systems, and I'm going to have a very, very brief description of linear systems in this course. You could spend a lot of time talking about linear systems. What I want to point out to you is the fact that a linear system just looks like this. It's a system where we take some input, put it through a system, and we get an output. You might be surprised to see that this picture looks exactly like a filter. And in fact, linear time invariant systems are linear time invariant filters. They're the same thing, except for our perspective. With a filter, typically we design the filter. Whereas with a system, typically you're given the system and you want to analyze the system, or you want to control the system, and so on. I know some of you are probably doing some control theory, so you probably spend a lot more time on linear systems in that course than I'm going to spend here. I'm going to spend not very long at all. But I want to point out some things to you. So classical sorts of linear systems are things like a pendulum or a vibrating string, where you have some sort of forcing term. So the classic thing for a vibrating string was you pluck the string. That's your input impulse. That's the input here. And then the system vibrates. That's your linear system. Electronic circuits can often be modeled as linear systems, where we have some input voltage, some output voltage. Often sensors are modeled as a linear system. When you have some sort of temperature sensor, quite often that temperature sensor doesn't actually tell you the real temperature. It tells you some function of that temperature. It may, for instance, you take a thermometer, it takes a thermometer a little bit of time to adjust to the ambient temperature. So you can look at that thermometer like a system. The ambient temperature is the input, the output is the temperature reading on the thermometer. So we can model a whole lot of things as linear systems. Linear systems have the same bunch of properties that we have for linear filters. Well, systems in general have the same bunch of properties we have for filters. We're going to be interested in the linear case. So All of these things are exactly the same sorts of things we've talked about already. So systems are just filters. Just a different way of thinking about the same sort of set of operations. We are again going to be looking at linear time invariant systems, at least at the starting point, because they correspond to these linear time invariant filters. And we know that filters correspond to convolutions. Convolutions are nice and mathematically tractable. So that's why we're going to look at them. As with filters, the system can be characterized by its transfer function. And the Fourier transform is the Fourier transform of impulse response is this very important quantity. You have to be aware that with filters, because we design them, we make them linear most of the time. With systems, you don't get the choice. The system is there, and systems are sometimes non-linear. Linearity is an approximation. This is really important. We have to consider the possibility that our system may have some non-linearities in it. As soon as you have non-linearities, all sorts of strange things can happen. So I have a really simple example here. A system where y is equal to x squared. So that's a simple system. It has no memory, has no weirdness in it, apparently, but it can do some strange things to a signal. So I'm taking a signal here, which is just a mixture of two sine waves with different frequencies. So I can compute the output. It's pretty straightforward to compute the square of this guy. The interesting thing though is when I take a product of two sines with different frequencies as I have here, I can rewrite that as a difference between two cosines, and you notice that the frequency of the cosine f0 minus f1 and f0 plus f1, these are frequencies that I didn't have in my original signal. So what's happened here is, when I have my nonlinear system, somehow it's introduced frequencies that I didn't have at the start. This is partly responsible, I think, for the beating phenomena you hear in musical instruments, where you have two musical instruments or two notes being played where the notes are slightly out of tune, and you hear a kind of wah-wah sort of noise. So nonlinear systems can really do some strange things, and we're going to stay away from them here. Even within linear systems, though, there's a whole lot of sort of interesting things to study. And again, I'm being very superficial here. One of the things that we care about a lot in linear systems is resonance. Resonance can be a really serious problem. You've probably all seen the Takona Narrows Bridge at some point in your careers. If you haven't, I recommend you go onto the internet and you follow some of my links and watch the movie. I just have a couple of pictures here. The Takona Narrows Bridge was a suspension bridge that was built, back in the 60s, I think. And it was revolutionary at the time. I think it was the longest bridge that had ever been built at the time. They used some new techniques. The suspension bridge thing, they thought they knew how to do. But one of the problems was this canyon that they built the bridge across has these gusting winds blowing down it. And they managed to build the bridge such that it resonated with these gusts. So instead of just having these gusts blow it a little bit, what happened was each time a gust came, it kind of swung it a little bit further along. Same sort of deal when you're a kid on a little swing. Each time you swing forward, you give yourself a little sort of kick with your legs. And even though each individual kick is very small, because they resonate, they sort of accumulate, and you get bigger and bigger swings. So this bridge actually ended up swaying really dramatically, really scarily. There were people on it at the time too. No one was actually killed, they all managed to get off, but the bridge did smash. Eventually, these oscillations destroyed the bridge. So understanding resonance is a pretty important thing here. Linear systems, we can do this pretty easily by looking at the transfer function. the transfer function tells you whether or not an input with a particular frequency is going to be amplified. If you have a particular frequency which gets amplified, you're getting resonance out of your system. Nonlinear systems, obviously, everything becomes a lot harder to deal with. So linear systems are interesting to study. Systems in general are interesting to study. As I said, we have a very superficial view of it here, but I do want to give you a little bit of a theory view of what goes on with these things. And this is leading somewhere. So I apologize if we get bogged down in the theory for a little while, but it is leading somewhere. What I want to try and get at is why the Fourier transform is such a good thing. Why it's nice. Why so many people have used it. Why it's so useful in such a wide bunch of sort of tasks. And it's directly linked to this linearity, this linear time invariant system sort of model. So remember, we have our Fourier transform. The filter is characterized by its impulse response in the time domain, its transfer function in the frequency domain. Armor filters, we have the coefficients in the time domain, or the poles and zeros in the complex plane, the Z-transform. And the Fourier transform swaps us between these two views of the world. So what I want to go through is a really quick little review of your linear algebra and some notation and various things like that to get us to the point where I can start explaining why the Fourier transform is a good idea and why sometimes it's not a good idea. So, again, for the people who are unfamiliar with what I'm going to talk about, go back, look at your first year math notes. A hell of a lot of what we're going to talk about today is just straight first year linear algebra. There's going to be a little bit more. We need to understand what a vector space is. So a vector space is some sort of non-empty collection of objects. You know, it's a vector space, so quite often these objects are vectors, but they don't have to be. They're just some sort of objects. And we have to have a couple of operators that go along with this vector space. One is going to be addition, the other one is going to be scalar multiplication. So addition just means we take two of our objects and we add them together. The vector space has to be what we call closed under addition. That means when we add two objects together, we get another object which is in the space. It's a standard concept in sort of mathematical formalisms. Closed under scalar multiplication means when we take a scalar multiple, that's a real number, a scalar, multiplied by our object, we also stay inside the vector space. So this is our idea of a vector space. The operators have to satisfy a bunch of properties. These are properties that you would expect naively addition and multiplication to always have. Actually, you can create mathematical systems where these properties don't hold. But for a vector space, we require all of these standard properties that we expect are going to happen, we require them to be true. Notice there are a few things like we have to have an identity, an additive identity, zero. So when we add zero to x, we get x back, and so on. So there are a few classic examples of vector spaces. The obvious one is vectors. So if we take a vector x in Rn, we can form a vector space of these. Rn is a vector space. Subspaces of Rn can also be vector spaces. So there's a whole lot of possible vector spaces that are just made up of vectors. Really simple. The name says it all. But that's not really all. There are also a bunch of functions that we could call a vector space. So this is one of those sort of classic ones. The continuous functions on the interval x0 to x1. The interval x0 to x1 is just all of the numbers between x0 and x1. So what this is saying is the set of functions which map this interval to a real number. For those of you who haven't seen this notation before, we just take any number in this interval and it gets mapped to a real number. It becomes a real number. That's what the function does. So we're going to take all of the functions which do that such that they're continuous functions. And we call that Cx0, x1. C stands for continuous. So keep this separate from the C we use for complex numbers. These are going to be real functions. You define addition and scalar multiplication in the natural, obvious way that you might do that. So the sum of two functions just means that when you take f plus g of x, it's f of x plus g of x. Scalar multiplication of alpha times f will give us alpha of f times x, for any alpha that's a real number, and any f and g which are continuous functions. I'll leave it as an exercise for you to prove that if you add two continuous functions together, you get another continuous function. Likewise with scalar multiplication. You can prove pretty easily, in fact, that these are, this set is closed under these operations. So this is different from our vector space. Why is it different? Well, in our vector space, the vectors, the values of the vectors, there's an infinite number of possible vectors in that space. So the space itself has an infinite number of objects in it. Typically, our vector spaces have an infinite number of objects in it. But importantly, the vector space here doesn't just have an infinite number of objects in it, but the dimension of these objects is infinite. In our vector space Rn, the dimension is n. We can characterize the vector space by n vectors. Here the dimension is infinite. There's an infinite number of possible functions, and they can take an infinite number of values along that interval. What does this mean? Well, the dimension is linked to the number of basis vectors you need for a vector space. If you have a vector space of dimension n, such as this guy, you need n basis vectors for that vector space. Here the dimension is going to be infinite. So we need an infinite number of basis vectors to describe that space. I'll tell you what a basis vector is. I'll define that a bit more precisely in a minute. But I just wanted to note that this is actually quite different from this thing. We also need to know about spaces like L2. L2 is just a set of functions which map the real numbers to real numbers such that this integral exists and is finite. Now, if I took an arbitrary function, I could create a function for which this integral doesn't exist, or for which that integral is infinite. But we're going to insist that L2 is just a set of functions where this thing is finite. And you can show that, as for this guy, this is also a vector space. Closed under addition, closed under scalar multiplication. We need a bit more structure than just a vector space. We need something to tell us about those vectors, and we typically do that with what we call a norm. Now, a norm is some sort of functional. Remember, a functional is kind of a function of functions. And what the norm does is it maps our objects, the things in our vector space, these guys, to a real number. And the thing about a norm is it has to satisfy a few properties. Greater than or equal to zero, it's only zero when the object, this is, remember, our additive identity. So the only time you get a norm of zero is when you apply the norm to the additive identity. It's just linear under these sort of scalar products, but it's not quite linear because it satisfies this thing called the triangle inequality. X, the norm of x plus the norm of y is greater than or equal to the norm of x plus y. Now, as soon as we have a vector space which has a norm, we call it a normed vector space. One of the interesting things, though, is that the norm is not unique for a vector space. There are a bunch of possibilities. So typically, we might use something like the Euclidean norm. So the Euclidean norm I'm going to write using this pair of double bars and a little 2, and it's just the square root of the squares of the values. It's the root of the squared values. It's like the RMS value, except we're not taking a mean here. But this is not the only norm that we could have on this space. Another norm, this one we call the L1 norm, is just the sum of the absolute values of the vectors. So this is an L2 norm, this is an L1 norm. The the two means L2, the one means L1. We can define norms on function spaces. For instance, this is my continuous function space, and here are three different norms that I define for it. This corresponds to the Euclidean one, the L2 norm. This is similar to my L1 norm here for the discrete vector. And this is, we call this an L infinity norm. It's just the maximum value of the function. Actually, supremum's a little bit more complicated than maximum, but you can think of it as a maximum for the purposes of what we need to understand today. The space L2 can be equipped with the norm, and typically when you look at L2, you use the L2 norm. So this is a very common norm that gets used again and again, either in this continuous form or this discrete form. And you notice, depending on the space, we can change the integral values, the range of the integral, and so on. So there are a whole lot of norms we could apply. I'm not going to go into any detail here, but we can define a set of spaces which are successively smoother and smoother. So C is just our continuous functions. C1 is the ones that the functions that have a continuous first derivative as well, all the way up to Cn, where we have continuous n derivatives. Now you can see that each of these spaces must get smaller and smaller. There must be a subset of this one. There must be a subset of the bigger space. Because all functions with a continuous first derivative are going to have a continuous, are going to be continuous. So given these sort of spaces, we can define a whole bunch of norms that look like this, F infinity J, where we take a sum over these supremums over the function. You don't have to know this. I'm not going to ask you an exam question about this norm. What I want to give you is an idea that this is a very general concept, and we can come up with some really creative sorts of norms. So once we have this norm, our vector space and the norm together we call a normed vector space, and we can define equivalence relationships between norms. Again, you don't really have to know this. The thing that we do have to think about is distances. The nice thing about a norm is it allows us to define a distance between two functions. The other operator that we typically use in a vector space is called an inner product. So you know about inner product. Classic inner product is just the dot product between two vectors. More generally though, we define or we write the notation for an inner product like this. It's a function of two functions or two objects in our space. So it maps S times S. There are two objects, you see, from the space. And it maps them to a real number. It's a linear operator. So there's a few properties of it. It's greater than or equal to zero, like our norm. F of F is only equal to zero if f equals zero. So these properties look a lot like the norm properties. But this one doesn't. This is a linearity property. This says that f plus g h is f g plus f h. We can swap the order. It's symmetric. And we have this other linearity property here. So we can think of this as what we might call a bilinear form. Bilinear symmetric form. Symmetric, it's linear, so on and so forth. So once we have our inner product, we can say we have an inner product space. Yep. What have I done wrong? Yes, it should. FH plus GH. Good. Thank you. No one noticed this last year. Yeah, this should be FH plus GH. Or I should put F of G plus H over the other side. We call this an inner product space. An inner product space automatically has a norm because I can take the square root of an inner product of a vector with itself and I can use that as a norm. And you'll see it will automatically have the appropriate properties for a norm. very classic examples of in a product. First one here I have is the dot product. This is just a dot product of two vectors. You've seen this in first year, possibly in high school. Second example of an inner product is an integral. So I have two functions in L2, and I'm going to take an integral of the product of those two functions and call that my norm. Again, you can take a whole lot of examples of this. This one is nice. If I take this one and I use this as my norm, then I get a norm like this. It's the L2 norm. So there's a lot of possibilities here, but people typically, quite often, they always use the same one. They say they use this in a product, they use this norm, they use L2 space. You see this again and again. So this is worth understanding, that this is an inner product for us. So then we come across the idea of orthogonality. The naive concept of orthogonality is that you have two lines that are at right angles to each other. We can generalize this to n dimensions by talking about orthogonal vectors. Orthogonal vectors are vectors where if you take the dot product, you get zero. We can generalize it to a vector space, any vector space we like, by saying that if f is not equal to g, then orthogonality means f, g has to be equal to zero. No point in talking about f being orthogonal to itself. Makes no sense. But f is orthogonal to g if the inner product is equal to zero. Now you can see that orthogonality is now a more general concept because the inner product is a general concept. Orthogonality of two vectors or two functions will depend on which inner product we use. But typically we always use the same one. So orthogonality comes down to a fairly standard idea of this notion of perpendicularity between two objects. Another way of thinking about it, think about two lines at a right angle. You have two lines at a right angle like this. What happens if I project this guy? Remember, a projection is I take this guy and I sort of project it onto here. When it's at right angles and I project it onto here, I get zero. The same is true with orthogonality. Projection is defined in terms of these inner products, in fact. How we do our projection is using this inner product. So when the inner product is zero, we get this idea that we projected onto that vector or that set or that object, and suddenly we get the zero object. We are going to use projection. We're going to talk about projection when we get to talk about wavelets. So it's important you start to get some degree of intuition about it now. Okay. Set of elements in a vector space are orthogonal if and only if each pair is orthogonal. That should be pretty obvious to you. You take some set and it's just saying that each pair in that set is orthogonal. So if you have a set of elements like this, Fi, which are all orthogonal, and then we take the inner product of a pair of them, we're going to get the Kronecker delta. Because if these two things are different, we get zero. If these two things are the same, then we're getting our norm. We know that can't be zero. In an orthonormal set, we define the orthonormal, we scale these guys such that when we take a vector, we take the inner product of a vector with itself, we get 1. So that's the difference between orthogonal and orthonormal. Orthonormal, as soon as we have an orthogonal set, it's easy to construct an orthonormal set because we can just use these sort of properties. We just scale some of the vectors such that the scaled value of these inner products becomes 1. So we often use orthonormal sets rather than orthogonal sets just because it's convenient. It's easier. You don't have to keep carrying around scale factors. You just have to remember the answer is going to be 0 or 1. So now we get to the idea of a basis. A basis for a vector space is some set of elements. The elements have to have two properties. Firstly, they have to span the set. Spanning means that if I take a linear combination of those, I can get any other element in the set. The second thing is they have to be linearly independent. What that means is I can't write any of these guys as a linear combination of any of the others. So once you have these two properties, you have a basis. Bases are useful because I can take any element in that set and I can write it as a linear combination of those basis vectors. That's what the span says. I can do that. I must be able to do it. And linear independence says there's no other way of doing it. It must be unique. When it's unique, that means that, you know, I know how to do it. It's always going to be the same. If I do it and you do it, we'll come up with the same representation. And that's worthwhile. Efficiency, the fact that there's no redundancy in this representation is also important. If there were redundancy, that would mean there's some extra things we carry around. It's extra computation, extra work, extra memory. So we want to have this nice efficient representation most of the time. Actually, there are cases where sometimes introducing some redundancy can be a good thing. We might get a chance to talk about that. The other nice thing about a basis is it's constructive. So once you have a basis, there is a procedure by which you can write any element of that set in terms of the basis, a linear combination of that basis. It's called the Gram-Schmidt procedure, typically. So it's not just a proof. It's a lot of mathematical proofs are, there exists, it's a nice ideal sort of thing, there exists out there something. The basis is not a there exists, it is a there exists. There exists a linear combination, but you also know how to find it. And that's useful because, you know, as signal processing people, we don't really care about the fact that something exists unless we know how to find it. So the point I want to leave us on at the break is that the transforms we've been looking at, essentially what they are is a change of basis. The Fourier transform, you transform from a basis where the basis are spikes, that is deltas, and you transform to a basis where the basis vectors or the basis objects are sines and cosines. In continuous space, the objects are continuous functions. The basis vectors are continuous functions, continuous sines and cosines. When we do the discrete Fourier transform, we start with objects that are vectors. Our signals are discrete, so they're vectors. And the transform transforms to a new vector representation where the basis vectors are discretized versions of the sines and cosines. So a change of basis or a transform are the same thing, typically. Things like the Fourier transform are just a change of basis, a change in the way that we represent the signal. This is a really fundamental thing. We never see the signal. We see a representation of it. We write down a representation of it. We have gotten so familiar with the time domain representation that we think it's special. It's not special. It's just a representation of that function. The Fourier representation, the Fourier transform, is not some weird thing that we have to learn about. It's an equally valid representation of that function. And you could imagine someone from Mars or Jupiter or somewhere like that who grew up and they only ever worried about sines and cosines and transforming, they call it the Engelbart transform, which transforms from the frequency domain into the time domain, and they have to learn about it in a class like this because they've never seen time domain representations. Equally valid points of view. So the question then becomes, why would you bother changing basis? What I want you to do in the break, so we have a little 10-minute break, I guess, is think a little bit about why. I have a little hint here. Why is it you might want to change basics? So we've got this idea of a change of basis now, which is pretty important. Change of basis really, it's really what we're doing with most transforms. And again, most of the time in this course, I'm going to be pretty loose about my formalism. I'm not going to try and be super strict about notions of bases and things like that. But today I just want to be a little bit stricter about what we're talking about here, partly because of this idea of trying to tell you what we're doing with a Fourier transform, but partly as well because some of these ideas of projection and inner products, we are going to use them further down the track. So it's useful for you to have been introduced to them earlier on so they have a chance to percolate through your brains. So let's go a step further. So if you remember back, I don't know how many of you do, back to your first year linear algebra lectures, you should have learned about eigenvectors and eigenvalues. So what are eigenvectors and eigenvalues? Well, imagine you have a vector x in Rn. We multiply it by a matrix A, and we get back the original vector but multiplied by a scalar. Then we would say that that scalar is lambda, it's the eigenvalue, and this vector is an eigenvector of the matrix A. This is a standard mathematical notion, and this sort of definition is the sort of thing that we teach in first year for eigenvectors, eigenvalues. You can equally define eigenvectors and eigenvalues for any operator that you come across. So I'm going to take some sort of operator on a vector space. So remember, this space is some space of objects. What the operator does is it takes an object and it turns it into another object in that space. So you can see that's what a matrix multiplication does. Multiply a vector by a matrix and you get another object in that space. I can apply my operator to some object from my space, perhaps a function, and if I get the same function back but multiplied by a scalar, then I would say that I have an eigenvector and eigenvalue of my operator A. So this idea of an eigenvalue, an eigenvector, is a general concept that applies to a vector space. It's not just linear algebra. Why do we care about eigenvalues and eigenvectors? Well, there are a whole bunch of reasons. But one of the standard reasons is when we deal with diagonalization. So for instance, take a matrix B, or matrix A. If there is a matrix P such that P to the minus 1 AP equals D, where D is a diagonal matrix like this, then we say that P diagonalizes A. So this matrix has values, non-zero values, along the diagonal, but everywhere else it's zero. A diagonal matrix like this is a special sort of matrix. It's useful. It doesn't take much memory to store because we only have to store these diagonal elements. We can write it like this. It's also useful computationally. We can use diagonal matrices in a sort of bunch of linear algebra tasks. This is just a little bit of stuff on that diagonalization, but when we have a matrix and we want to diagonalize it, what we do is we take its eigenvectors and we make them into the columns of P, scaled appropriately such that P to the minus 1 looks nice as well. So when we have this set of eigenvectors, we can construct this P. And the resulting D, the diagonals, has the eigenvalues along the diagonal. So this is why the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors are useful in the context of diagonalization. Because when we diagonalize, we get the eigenvalues here, and we use the eigenvectors to construct this matrix P, which we use for the diagonalization. Now, why would this be important to us? Well, it's useful in a whole bunch of contexts, but the standard one is when we're dealing with a dynamic system. For instance, let me write down a really simple dynamic system here. I'm going to have the state of the system is going to be represented by, say, Xn. Xn tells me some variables of the system. It tells me the state the system's in. And then I'm going to assume that the system evolves like this. At each time step, I can work out the state at time n from the state at time n minus 1 just by multiplying by a matrix. There are a whole lot of systems that you can describe like this. Classic examples are things like Markov chains. We can do that. We can always write xn as a to the n x0. To compute this, this would tell me what xn is. To compute this, though, I'd have to perform n matrix products. Matrix product takes order n cubed operations. So that would be a really computationally heavy thing to do, except that if I notice this diagonalization, I can always write this as something along these lines. And it's dead easy to take the nth power of a diagonal matrix because d to the n equals diag lambda 1 to the n lambda 2 to the n, and so on, up to lambda m. So it's dead easy to perform that that exponentiation. The other thing is this tells us the long-term behavior. Imagine what happens as n goes to infinity. If this guy is greater than 1, it would tend to infinity. If this guy is less than 1, it tends to 0. If it's 1, it's just going to stay at 1. So we can work out the long-term behavior of this system by looking at these eigenvalues. So this diagonalization process is very helpful for us when we're analyzing this dynamic system. Why is that? Well, what it does is it decouples it. Imagine that you have a system of n linear differential equations. Now we know how to solve systems like that. One of the things you can do is diagonalize that system of equations. When you do that, it decouples the individual equations, so you end up having to solve n separate DEs. Instead of n DEs, which are all somehow linked together in some complicated way, you just solve the individual DEs. You know how to solve a simple one-dimensional DE. And so that's a lot easier for you. This decoupling means you can do the analysis of a bunch of individual systems. In this case, each of these is like one individual little system that's independent of all the others. All I need to know is lambda to the power of n, and that tells me about its evolution. I don't need to know how it interacts with all the other bits of that system because I've decoupled them. So this is where diagonalization is a really useful operation for us. The trick, the nice thing about the Fourier transform is it's a change of basis, but it's a diagonalization. This change of basis here, this diagonalization is kind of like a change of basis. Well, the Fourier transform is very similar. So let's think about why that is. Imagine that we have some set of functions in time, and we're going to apply a filter to them. So we take a convolution of our filter with the function. We can think of this as an operator of the function. I'm applying an operator to that function. It's mapping that function to another function. That's all filtering does. So we can think of our filter as an operator. Obviously, if we have a time invariant filter, linear time invariant filter, it's just a convolution. Now, or a linear time invariant system for that matter. Now, the trick is, imagine that I put, instead of this function here, I put a complex exponential. When I apply this operator to a complex exponential, I know what the result is going to be. I know it's the transfer function applied to that complex exponential. How do I know that? Well, that's what the transfer function does. If I take an input sinusoid at a particular frequency, it either amplifies it or it attenuates it. And it does that independently of all the other frequencies. That's what our filters do. Remember, we have a low-pass or a high-pass filter, a low-pass filter. It amplifies the low frequencies and attenuates the high frequencies. And it doesn't matter, there's no correlation between what's happening there, except via the transfer function. So, I can write down the operation on an exponential, one of these complex exponentials, just by the transfer function. In fact, this should be an AS here. This should not be an A of F, this should be an A of S. Well, A of S is the transfer function, and S is the frequency. So, look at this, the formulas thing. On both sides I have the operator applied to a function, and on this side I have a scalar. The transfer function of S is just a scalar applied to the same object, the same object for my vector space. So this thing is just an eigenvalue equation. These complex exponentials are the eigenvectors, and the transfer function values, they are the eigenvalues. Go back and look at the equation here. This is the same equation. I have a function here, it's a complex exponential. That becomes one of my eigenvectors. The lambdas are the eigenvalues. And in this case, they're just the values of the transfer function. So this is an eigenvector equation. When we transform, when we do a transform of some function f, no, sorry, so some filter a, we're transforming and we get this transfer function. These are the eigenvalues, so you can imagine them being along the diagonal of the matrix. So what we've done is a sort of diagonalization here. We don't write it as a matrix, we just write down the transfer function, but that's what we do back here. I don't bother to write a matrix like this every time, I just write it like this, diag D1, D2. In our case, we write it the Fourier transform equals A of S, where A of S is just a series of values, a vector for a discrete process and a continuous function for a continuous process. So the diagonalization, again, you know, the way we do the diagonalization here is we do a product of this matrix, which corresponds to a series of inner products of these vectors with our operator. We can write that as a series of inner products, or integrals in the case of a continuous Fourier transform, or this sum that we have for our Fourier transform. Remember, we can write the Fourier transform as a matrix product. So that's what's going on here. The Fourier transform is like a diagonalization. And because of that, it gives us a very useful, nice, compact, mathematically tractable way of describing or analyzing a linear time-invariant system, our system A, just treating it like an operator. So the Fourier transform is key to this idea of a linear time-invariant system. Linear time-invariant systems, we know, are not the only systems out there, though. In fact, a lot of the real systems out there are non-linear. A lot of real systems have transients, that's non-stationary components. They have bits where they're not time-invariant. Think about signals coming out of my, think about the signals coming out of my voice at the moment. I just stopped for a minute. Now I'm starting again. There are transients. There are things that aren't continuous in that signal. They don't. Now eventually this lecture, you no doubt be hoping eventually this lecture stops. And then it goes away. That signal will end. There are transients there. It's not this nice time invariant signal, nice time invariant system that you're listening to. So given that, is the Fourier transform the right approach? And the answer is, not really. It still can be useful, but there are some better techniques, and this is where we start to get to wavelets. But there are still a few things we need to know before we get to wavelets.